I'm Frank Jones. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Frank.
And it's really good to be here. And I got to tell you this, that I was in Denver at about 4 o'clock your time, and the flight was delayed. And then they canceled the airplane because there couldn't get any pressure in it. And I don't know about you, I don't know how you get when things don't go the way you expect them to get. Maybe you're an alcoholic that's serene and wonderful, and you walk hand in hand with God. And that's good if you do. I am not one of those. Because what happens to me is when I got there, I got to Denver 11 o'clock this morning, which would be about 1 o'clock your time. Flight was scheduled to leave at 2. And I'm sitting at the gate 15, and they say, well, no, St. Louis is at gate 19. And so I picked up my bag and went to gate 19. And at about 1:30, they said, well, the flight that you're supposed to take hasn't come in from Dallas. And we don't know when we're going to get a flight to St. Louis. Now, I don't know what that does to your stomach. When you have to be someplace, you know it's important, and the folks there expect you there. And I would like to thank the committee and Mary Beth and Jim and them for asking me to come and participate here. It is an honor, and I'm privileged to be here. And so I needed to be here, so my stomach starts to grind. And then they tell me that we're not going to take that airplane. They've ordered another airplane, and it has pressure problems in the cabin. And what I do, I don't know about you, but I started to evaluate the people in the airport. I can immediately start seeing the people that are self-obsessed and totally into themselves and have no regard for other people. It's the people that set their briefcases on the chairs in the waiting area by the gate. Why does their briefcase need a seat? I started to think about that. And when I think about that, I start to get angry at those people. I think about throwing that briefcase down the hallway of the airport. And then they tell me the flight's not going to take off until 3:40 Denver time, and we're not going to get in here until 6:30. And I started to evaluate people that were eating around the terminal and dropping their food on the floor. And the people that are rushing and pushing around, I just got aggravated as hell, I got to tell you. And AA worked in those people's lives, and they ain't even involved in the program. And then we get on the plane, and we taxi out to the runway, and there's too much wind, and so we're taxiing around the Denver airport looking for a runway that doesn't have a wind shear factor. And I make a comment, just loud enough so the stewardess and folks can hear it, that if I'd have known I was going to drive to goddamn St. Louis, I'd have brought my own vehicle. I didn't have very good service on the airplane. And they didn't feed me, and I only got one package of nuts. I've never had a break. Anyway, I'm glad that I'm here, and I want to thank Jim for picking me up at the airport. It is an honor, and I got to tell you, I'm grateful that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not a well person. What I try to do is act better than I feel, and I try not to act on every thought that I have. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that. And I'm glad that I've stayed around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to find out that I don't have to react to every thought I have or think that everybody's out just to get me angry or to push my buttons and that I can go on with life. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I don't always want to go to meetings. I don't know about you here in St. Louis, Missouri, but I don't always want to go to meetings. I mean, I get tired. I mean, I've been up since, and John's already been on my case, but I've been up since 5 o'clock this morning. I could have just stayed in Denver. I don't want to be here. But you know what? Something funny happens wherever I'm at that when I get in my automobile and I drive to a meeting whether I want to go or not, and I get in that meeting and I get to talk to some folks like I did tonight, and I get to see some old friends that I've known for a long time, and then I listen to Chapter 5 read, and I listen to the 12 traditions, and then at the coffee break of the meetings I go to, I get to talk to some more people, and then after the meeting I get to talk to them, and I listen to the speaker of participation. Something funny happens when I leave that meeting, I feel better. I don't go to meetings because I'm suicidal or anxiety-ridden or depressed. I go to meetings today because when I leave that meeting, I feel better. And that's why I go to meetings. I got a sponsor, and I don't always want to call him. It's an imposition when you're a busy man like me. I got more important things to do sometimes. I may have to go to lunch with somebody and mooch a lunch off of them. And I don't always want to call my sponsor, but I call my sponsor, and I'm working in Canada now, and I hadn't anticipated that. But Monday through Friday, I call my sponsor. And I dial his phone number, and when I hear that man's voice, something funny happens. I can't explain to you what happens. He doesn't say anything important or profound, It's just that when I hear my sponsor's voice, I feel better. That's why I call my sponsor. I call my sponsor because I feel better after I talk to him. We have 12 steps here in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were read to you tonight out of chapter 5. And man, I don't want to work those 12 steps. That ain't macho. That ain't cool to do that. When I got here, I wasn't powerless over alcohol. I could drink a lot of it. My life wasn't unmanageable. I not only managed my life, I managed everybody's life around me. I couldn't deal with the insanity step. Step 2, I wasn't insane. I watched and listened to you people, and I knew you were crazy. And so that pertained to you. It didn't pertain to me when I got here. The third step said, turn my world and life over to care of God. When I got here, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not believe in a God. I had done too many bad things to too many people. I wasn't ever going to write an inventory and read it to another human being. I didn't want anybody to know my secrets. I had done a lot of bad things. I was ashamed of a lot of the things I did. I had no defects of character or shortcomings. I didn't. I got all of them in here. I think it's secretly your fault. I was just a nice guy that drank too much when I got here. And then it says that I got to make a list of the people I'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them. And the way I looked at it, I didn't harm anybody that didn't deserve it. I didn't bang anybody out in a bar or any place else that didn't say something first to me. And then it says that I got to make direct amends, and I don't want to do that. And then I got to continue to take that inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. And I figured it was your program. If I wait long enough, you'll apologize to me. And then it says that I...
All right.
Exactly. And then it tells me that I've got to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with a God I didn't believe in. And I got to tell you that even a little over 18 years sober, I do not do well with meditation today. I don't know about you. And I do the best I can in the morning. I just can't seem to clear my mind and get quiet. Because when I sit alone, I self-obsess. When I sit alone, I think about me, the only person I've ever truly loved. When I start thinking about things, I start thinking about naked women. I'm not trying to embarrass anybody. I'm not trying to be funny. It's just what I do. And then I think about robbing an armored car and taking them to the Bahamas. So that's when I meditate, I get crazy thoughts in my head. And then it says, as a result of working those 12 steps, that I'm going to have an experience here and I'm going to be able to help the alcoholic that still suffered. And I just didn't believe in any of that when I got here. But something funny happens when I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I apply those 12 steps in my life to the best of my ability out there in public. Because in AA, I have no problems working the 12 steps with you people and being kind to you, sticking my hand out and doing those things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have a problem in meetings. I have a problem at home. I have a problem around a wife and kids that don't understand my intense emotions and how angry I get and how perfect I want things and I want it my way and when I want it. Like the people in the airport. I had to work the 12 steps there. I got to work them on the freeways and the highways where people don't know how to drive. And when I do that out there, I feel better. That's why I work the 12 steps. So I can feel better outside of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no reason for being an alcoholic. My mom and dad never held a gun to my head and said, Frank, we want you to drink and make an ass out of yourself or we'll kill you. I cannot stand up here and blame my parents for me being an alcoholic. I can't blame my wives, my kids, the jobs I've had, or the places I've been. I am an alcoholic because I drank like a pig. And when I didn't drink, I acted like a pig. That's the bottom line. I am responsible for my actions, past and present. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in Danville, Illinois, into a good family. Mom and Dad were married to each other 50 years. Dad provided a good home. Mom was at home. She was a good mother, and she provided us a place to grow up that was clean and decent and provided for me and my two brothers. And that's not why I'm an alcoholic, because they're not alcoholics, and they treated us kids great. I also grew up with the ability to play sports, and I had an ideal childhood growing up. I played Little League Baseball, Pony League. I played sports in high school. I won 9 letters. I had offers to go to college to play basketball. And I just had a great childhood. I did everything that kids want to do here in the Midwest growing up. I came down to Sportsman's Park. I seen Stan Musial play, Red Shandy's, Kenny Boyer. I was a Cardinal fan. That's just the way it was with me. I had a great childhood. That ain't why I'm an alcoholic. You see, there's some other things. When I come into AA and I worked that inventory and I wrote that stuff out and I read it to my sponsor and we talked about my defects of character and shortcomings, and I had to look back over my childhood, and I got to tell you, I'm not looking for an inner child. If I ever find that little sumbitch, I'll choke him unconscious. Because I would like to grow up someday and be mature, and I just have a hard time with it. But when I look back over growing up, there's some other things that took place in my life that I didn't analyze, didn't think about. I just did it because that's what all the kids were doing back then. I was a shoplifter. I was a thief. And I was a liar. And I cheated all the time because it's just easier to do those things. I'd lie and cheat and steal today if I could get away with it and didn't have to make amends. Because it's just an easier thing to do. I grew up, I wanted to be macho. I mean, look at me. I look like Mr. Peepers, for Christ's sakes. In high school, I was afraid of the dark. I couldn't tell anybody I was afraid of the dark. I was ashamed of that. And I couldn't talk about that until I was in AA and sober a while. But that's how I was growing up. I was a thief and a liar and a cheat, and I wanted to be a macho guy. But I'm afraid of the dark, and I looked like a wimp, and I hated feeling like a wimp. And that's how my insides were. And I'd hang out on Main Street after ball practice, and I'd hang out with juvenile delinquents with long sideburns and ducktail haircuts, and they carried switchblade knives and bicycle chains, and that was an adrenaline rush for a wimp like me. And then they'd have rumbles, and they'd beat hell out of each other, and I'd watch you guys do that, you tough guys that did that, and it didn't bother you. You'd go on and hit the next guy with a chain or cut him with a switchblade, and you went on to the next one and the next one, and it didn't bother you, and I could tell by looking at you, and I'd hit somebody with a club or a brick and feel sorry for them. And I would go home and worry about if they were hurt. That's how it was before I ever drank alcohol. And I didn't analyze that growing up. That's the way I was. My first drink was in Danville. It was at a party. It was a hot summer night. My girlfriend brought me over a big iced tea glass full of slow gin and 7-Up. And I didn't know what slow gin was, and it was red, and it looked good, and it was hot, and I took a drink, and it tastes like strawberry Kool-Aid, and that was my drink of choice. And so I chugged that glass of slow gin and 7-Up down. And nothing happened. A lot of men's speakers get up here, and they talk about what their first drink did in their stomach, and they got all warm and fuzzy, and they felt it at the tips of their fingers, and a lot of the guys out here all got 6 feet four, 240 pounds, and all their pimples fell off. And that didn't happen to me. I just drank it down because it was hot. I gave her the glass, said, go get me another one, and she brought me another glass of slow gin and 7-Up. And I drank that glass down. And I didn't go and get an old dirty trench coat, put it on, and throw a bottle of wine in a paper bag and head to Skid Row. I didn't plan on being an alcoholic. That wasn't my intentions in high school. It was to go to college and play basketball and be macho. So I didn't do that. I drank about a gallon of slow gin in about 30 minutes. I just kept chug-a-lugging it down. There was no effect, no nothing. I didn't get knee-walking, commode-hugging, puking on your dress shoes drunk. 30 minutes after my last glass of slow gin and 7-Up, I found out where slow gin got its name. I got drunk as hell. I went into a blackout. I got taken home that night. I passed out. And the next morning when I come to, I'm puking up red stuff all over the bedroom. I am sicker than a dog. I got a terrible hangover and a headache and an upset stomach, and I'm puking this red stuff up, and I am sick, and there's something else that's funny about that. I can't remember how I got home that night. I didn't know what a blackout was when I was in high school in Danville, Illinois. I didn't know until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out what a blackout was. It's an indication I had a problem drinking. Normal drinkers don't have blackouts. I didn't know that. I thought all those guys that drank with me that night had the experience I had. And I found out that for me a blackout is that when I drink alcohol, I continue and do whatever it is I'm doing that night. And then the next morning or some periods during the night, I have amnesia. And I can't remember the next morning what I did. And I'd wake up and I'd be with my wife or my girlfriend, and they'd tell me about a movie or a party or something we had went to, and I had no recollection of ever going. That's a blackout. That's an indication I had a problem drinking. And then I'd go to the bars, and I'd leave a bar, and I'd walk out to get my car, and my car's missing. How do you lose a 4,000-pound automobile? And then I'd call the police, and I'd report it stolen. And the police would come, and the bar would clear out, and I'd walk outside, and my car would be parked right where I left it. And I said, I guess they brought my car back. And at the end of my drinking, I'd wake up in some dark, crappy place. I don't know where I am. And I'm laying there in bed, and I'm scared, and it's dark, and there's something in bed with me, and I don't know where in the hell I got it. And the hair's all matted down on it. And it should have been tagged by the Humane Society, whatever it is. I do not know where I got this at. And those are the things you got to sneak out of the room before it wakes up. Oh, it's going to harm you. I know it will. Those are blackouts. Those are indications I had problems drinking back then. I missed 3 days of school with a hangover. I went back to school and the guys told me about that night. They told me I was dancing and laughing and funny. And what I did when they told me that is I felt a part of those guys. That's why I drank that night. I didn't drink for taste or effect. I drank because all my buddies at that party were drinking and having a good time, and I wanted to have a good time. And when they told me what I did that night, I felt a part of those guys even though I didn't remember it. They told me I was dancing and laughing, and me and my girlfriend were necking in the corner, and I felt macho. And I didn't turn into a blazing alcoholic after that. They told me I got in a fight that night, and I hit some guy, and that made me feel like a macho guy. And I didn't just start drinking and hanging out on Skid Row and drinking wine out of a bag after that. I drank when I could get it. And when I drank, I got drunk. When I got drunk, I got in fights because I'm afraid of everybody, and the only way to keep you away from me is to fight. And then I'm a thief, and if you dare me to do something, I got to go do it because that's what I do. That's what macho guys do, is they can do a dare. And I thought those things made me a man. I had a total misconception of what a man was. But I drank all the time, and I blacked out, and I got in trouble. And 2 weeks before graduation from high school, I had this offer to play basketball, and I don't know about you, but I got a committee in my head. And my committee started to talk to me. And my committee says, what if you go to that college and don't make that basketball team? What if you don't get grades good enough to stay on that team? Well, I don't know what that does to you, but that scares me. I get full of fear. I don't want to look bad in front of all those guys in college and all those cool women and stuff. I don't want to look like a wimp and a wussy and not make the team or fail out of college. And so my committee's talking to me, and I come up with a keen alcoholic decision. I quit high school. You can't go to college if you don't graduate high school. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And so I quit high school, and then I made another keen alcoholic decision. I joined the Marine Corps. If you're a wimp and a wussy and you're afraid of the dark, you don't go into Marines. That's a bad deal. I should have went in the Air Force. That's it, or the Navy, for Christ's sakes. That's what I should have did. But I didn't know. I went in the Marine Corps, and I'm sitting on a train getting ready to go up to Chicago to get sworn in, and I'm scared, and I'm homesick, and I'm lonely, and the train ain't moved yet. And I'm sitting next to a guy with a black leather jacket on with zippers all over it, and he's got a ducktail haircut and long sideburns, and he's joining the Marines. And he's drinking the stuff out of a little brown bottle in a paper bag. And I want to hang out with him in Chicago because I'm afraid to go up there by myself because I'm a wimp. And he says, do you want a drink of this? And I said, sure I do. And so I took that bottle and I chugged like 4 or 5 big mouthfuls of it. It was whiskey. I don't know how you drank whiskey when you were 17. I sprayed that crap all over the seat in front of me. I puked it back up. I had tears running out of my eyes. I had whiskey and snot running out of my nose. I couldn't breathe. This guy's looking at me. I want to fit in with him. I don't know how quick you were when you were drinking, but I was quick. I wiped off my face and mouth. I handed him the bottle, and I said, that was pretty good. That's how I drank. I drank to fit in. I drank to be a part of. I got sworn in, and I ended up at Marine Corps Recruit Depot, and I went through boot camp afraid. I was scared. I was homesick. I was in boot camp with a bunch of older guys. They were all 19, 20-year-old. And I had to suck it up and put that facade out there and act like a macho guy, what I thought macho was. And I got through boot camp and ended up at Camp Pendleton, and that Cuban crisis broke out in 62, and we went through the Panama Canal, and I was just scared to death. I didn't feel like a man. I felt like a wimp. And then after the Cuban crisis, we went back through the Panama Canal, and we went to the Far East, and over there we unpacked on Okinawa, and the guys come up, and they said, hey, Frank, we're going to go get drunk. You want to go with us? And I felt like a man because they asked me to go get drunk with them, and they're Marines. And so I went out to get drunk with them, and we bought a Typhoon Fifth of sake, and it holds about 2 gallons. Costs about 75 cents back then. And they started passing that bottle of sake around, and they're chug-a-lugging it, and they're laughing and slapping each other on the back, doing the male bonding. And that bottle of sake got around to me, and I chug-a-lugged 4 or 5 big mouthfuls of it. It looked like water. Now, I don't know how you drank sake at the age of 17. I sprayed that crap all over their shoes. I couldn't breathe. It almost knocked me out. I got sake and snot running out of my nose. And they're laughing and pointing at me, and I felt like a wimp again. And you got to suck it up. And so the bottle comes around, and I'm feeling like a wimp, and I chug-a-lug some more, and I puked it back up again. And I drank it, and I puked it up, and I learned one thing right then. If I am going to be an alcoholic, I can't let looking bad bother me. I got to hang in. You got to hang in to be an alcoholic. And I finally held enough sake down and something funny happened. And I remember it very distinctly. I looked at those 5 or 6 other Marines I was drinking with and I realized something. Those guys are punks. Why am I hanging out with these sissies? And what I'm telling you is alcohol worked for me. Alcohol allowed me to be anything I wanted to be. I could put that pretend out there and I acted what I thought macho was. And I left those guys. I went out drinking on my own. When I drank, I didn't need anybody. I didn't need you. And I'm drinking in a bar, and I'm shooting pool with another Marine, and I'm drinking. And he said something I took offense to, and I smacked him in the face with a pool cue. I seen it in the movies. It was cool. And he's laying there bleeding, and I got scared. And I got that fear, and it gripped my stomach, and that anxiety, and I knew I'm in trouble, and I'm scared now. And I got to get the hell out of that bar, and they're calling the MPs, and I run down through Hinoco, through the alleys, into another bar, and I sit there, and I ordered a couple of shooters and a beer, and I'm drinking, and something funny happens as I'm sitting there drinking. that guilt and that shame and that fear goes away, and I'm feeling macho. And I start to brag about hitting to the Marine sitting on a bar stool next to me. That's what alcohol did for me. It took away all that guilt and the shame and the fear and the crap I couldn't deal with in my stomach, and I didn't know that then. It's just that I changed when I drank. And then I look down at the end of the bar, and there's a Nason sitting down there. And I'm a sucker for a pretty face, and she slid up next to me and asked me to buy her a drink. And what are you going to do, for Christ's sakes? So I bought her a drink, and then she told me about her sick mom that needed surgery, and it broke my heart. And so I gave her some more money, and her and I trudged the road of happy destiny to her hooch. And I'd like to stand up here tonight and tell you what a great time we had, and she probably remembers it to this day. But 17-year-old and drunk as a bicycle, and it was over too quick for me to remember it to this day. But she went to clean up, and when she did, I don't know about you, but that hurt my ego and my machissimo, see? And I felt like a wimp and a wussy, and I hated that. And so I stole my money back out of her headboard and set her house on fire. That just made sense to me. I don't know where that come from. And I went back to the base, and I passed out, and at Reveille the next morning I come to, and I got a terrible hangover, and I'm puking up everything I had eaten and drank that night, and I'm sicker than a dog, and I have no recollection of what transpired out in the Ville that night. I didn't know what went on. And the guy started telling me the MPs are looking for who hit that guy with a pool cue. And I got scared again. And that fear come back, and it gripped me again, and I'm terrified now. I know I'm going to the brig. Then they tell me about a fire in the Ville. And I felt a lot of shame over that. You see, my father hadn't raised me to treat women that way. I felt really bad about that. I was ashamed of that. I was full of fear. I had a lot of remorse and guilt, and I didn't know what I was going to do about that, you see. And if my parents ever found out, and here I'm in the Marine Corps, but if my parents found out, I knew I was in a lot of trouble, because that ain't how you treat women. And I found out a secret that morning in Okinawa. I opened up my locker, and there was a bottle in it with a big red dot on it, and that was Akadama wine. And I took that wine down that morning, and I unscrewed the cap on it, and I chug-lugged 3 or 4 big mouthfuls of it, and I didn't puke it back up. So I drank a little bit more wine, and I went out to formation, and I come back in, and by the time that had elapsed, something funny happened to me. My headache was gone, and my stomach settled down. I didn't have a hangover no more. I don't know what that tells you, but what that tells me is if I drink in the morning, I ain't got to be sick. That made sense to me. I liked that thought, so I drank some more wine that morning. And then something else happened. That guilt and that shame I felt over my actions the night before I was told about went away, and I started to brag about those things because I thought that made me a man. I thought that made me macho. And at that day, I became a morning drinker and a daily drinker at the age of 17, and all my money went on booze and the bars, and I'm a bar drinker, and I'm a bar fighter, and I'm too light to fight and too thin to win, and I developed the technique of ambush. And they got big glass ashtrays back then and big glass bottles of beer and stuff, and I used to use those as weapons, and I started getting in a little trouble in the Marine Corps, and I'd find myself restricted to the barracks, and I'd make a rank, and I'd lose it, and I'd make the PFC again, and I'd lose it. And then they'd restrict me to the base, and if anybody had ever come up to me and say, "Hey, Frank, you know it's that alcohol. Every time you drink, you get in trouble," I could have given you reasons why that's not true. You see, it's not the alcohol. You see, if that guy hadn't said that to me in the bar, I wouldn't have hit him. And if she hadn't acted that way, drinking tea when I thought she was drinking whiskey, I wouldn't have threw the shot glass through the mirror. And if that guy hadn't left his locker open with his wallet there on the top shelf, I wouldn't have taken some of his money. So it ain't my fault. It's their fault. And it's his fault and her fault and the CO's fault. And then it got to be the wife's fault and the kid's fault and the boss's fault. And all my life, till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I blamed everybody around me for everything that happened to me. It's the police. It's the military. And I rationalized and justified all my actions. And this is the only disease in the world that's killing you, and your head says you ain't got a problem with it. It's always somebody else. It's always something else. If I had more money, if I had more this or that, if she just leave me alone, if I, me, I am the mighty I am. And it's not. It was me. And I didn't know that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ended up running out of money over there. I needed to drink, and I decided to rob a cab driver. They're always overcharging us. I knew that. I knew the meters were fixed over there in the Far East. And he fought back, and I picked up a rock the size of a softball, and I beat his face in with it, and that man almost died. And I was in a lot of trouble. And my dad flew to Okinawa, and he had some political pull, and he met with a commanding general, and the only deal was I did not want to be thrown out of the Marine Corps. It's the only thing I knew how to do. And some deals were cut somewhere, and to make a long story short, by the time paperwork went through to get me released from the brig and sent to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina from the Far East, I had spent a year locked up in that brig. And if you'd have told me it was behind alcohol, I could have given you 95 reasons why it wasn't, and 5 more reasons why I should have never been in the brig, because that's how my mind worked. And I got out of that brig after a year, and I went to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and I met a girl up in Illinois when I swung through there on my way down to Jacksonville, and she was just out of high school, and I married her. And she wanted a husband, and I took her to North Carolina with me, and she wants me to stay home. But I'm a bar drinker. I got to be out there in those bars with the macho guys and the beautiful women. And so I don't know about you, but what I would do is I would start a fight with her. I would start the fight, I would pick the fight, and we would have the cuss fights that alcoholics have. And then I got to break stuff up because I get angry, and then I can't stay in the house with that woman that's yelling and screaming and crying. That makes me crazy, and that gives me my excuse to get out in those bars. And I did that night after night and day after day. And I'd go out in those bars and I'd be drinking. I'd get in a fight with some guy again to show everybody how tough I was. I'd leave a bar and I'd go down to another bar and I'd see some woman in the bar and her and I would lock eyes and knew that she would be able to fix it for me because I need to be validated because I don't feel like a man. We'll be here when you get back, babe. Take your time. And I got to be validated because I don't feel like a man. And so I need a woman to tell me I'm a man and show me I'm a man because I have no self-worth, no nothing. And so we'd go do what we had to do, and I'd be laying there in bed sobering up. When we got done, and I start to think, and that's a bad deal. Shouldn't think when you're drinking and sobering up. But I started to think, and I thought about that wife at home who hadn't done nothing. And now I feel guilty. You know why? Because I'm guilty. You feel like a liar because you're a liar. You feel like a cheat because you're a cheat. And now I can't go home and face that woman because you know when I'm sober, I know it ain't her, I know it's me. So before I head back home, I stop and have a couple of drinks. And what happens then is I don't feel so guilty, I feel kind of macho. I've had a pretty cool night, and I can go home and face her now. And I walk in the door and she says, "Where have you been?" I hate that question. Now I got to lie to her. I wouldn't be a liar if she didn't ask questions like that. What's up with her asking me those questions? Forcing me to be a liar. I hate that. And then we'd have another cuss fight, and it's back out in the bars, and I'm repeating the same actions over and over again, thinking I'm going to get a different result, and that's insanity. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I found out was is I'm too immature to be a husband. I didn't know that. My intentions all my life was to be like my dad. He was a good husband, a good father, a good man, treated my mom with respect. They were married 50 years. That was my intentions. And I don't know where I went wrong, and what you guys told me to do is never tell my wife what to do. You guys told me it's none of my business what she wears. It's none of my business how she cooks dinner or what she cooks for dinner. It's none of my business how she cleans that house. If I don't like how the house looks, clean it myself. That's what you told me. You told me that she is absolutely none of my business, that I need to take care of me, and if I take care of me, everything else will work out fine. And I had to learn how to be a husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's because of the old-timers in the group and the people that I associate with that I had to learn that. And then we had a kid. Now, I don't know how to treat kids. Kids cry, make messes, break things, spill stuff, crap their diapers. I mean, what's up with that? People ain't supposed to act that way. That made me crazy. And I'd yell at the kid. The kid would cry. I'd shake her. I'd take her in the room. I'd throw her in that crib. She'd cry. God, that guilt and that shame. Then the wife would come in and start on me, and we'd have a cuss fight, and then they'd both be crying. I don't know about you, but I can't drink in some place like that. I mean, who in the hell can handle that? And I feel that guilt and that shame because I know I'm a bad father. I know I mistreat my kids. I got to get the hell out of there and get in those bars because the only thing that takes that shame away is alcohol. The only thing that allows me to feel half human after acting the way I acted at home is a couple of drinks. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I found out here is I was too immature to be a father. I didn't know that. I wanted to be like my dad. I didn't want to treat my kids that way. And when I came here, I had to watch you with your kids. And I had to learn how to be a dad. And what you guys taught me is kids are little people. And when they grow up, they make messes. And they spill things, and they touch things, and they move things around. That's how they learn. And what I had to learn is patience and tolerance. And that's what you people taught me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was ashamed for a long time after sobriety how I treated my children. And those are the hardest amends you got to make. And I still make more amends to my kids today, and they're all grown, than I ever do to anybody else. But you know what? I'm a better dad today than I was over 18 years ago. You know, then I got called into the CO's office one day, and they issued me a rifle with a telescope on it, live ammunition, and they sent me across the ocean to a place called Vietnam. And I got to tell you right now, Vietnam ain't my problem. Vietnam is not my problem, and in California, I get tired of hearing guys whine about that crap at the podium. I have been to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in my 18-plus years of sobriety, and I have not seen it yet. I may see it someday. But I haven't seen it to date. I have never seen an NVA soldier walk in an AA meeting, take a Vietnam vet out at gunpoint, and make him drink. You know, I don't know what's up with that. I'm going to tell you, Vietnam ain't my problem. My problem was, when I got to Vietnam, I was afraid. I couldn't tell anybody about that fear. You see, I'm a Marine. Marines ain't afraid of anything except I was. And I was ashamed of being afraid. And I was a sniper. I was up at Quezon and Conti Inn in 1967, 68. I was working with recon, and I was terrified. And I couldn't tell anybody about that fear. How do you tell another Marine you're afraid? You guys didn't look afraid. And I was scared. And then the other thing, what I seen happen in war made me sick at my stomach. And macho guys don't get sick, except I did. And I was ashamed of that. How can I live with that? And I found out a secret in Vietnam. 151 proof rum in my canteen. I'm bulletproof and invisible when I drink that. Now I can go out on the patrols and I can do the things I got to do to show everybody in my unit what a man I am and how macho I am. And then when I come back in the harbor side, I would drink that stuff and it'd take that shame and that guilt away that you feel after you do those things. And I did a lot of bad things to a lot of people over there, and I'm not proud of that. I got to tell you that. And I have a different perspective of macho today, and that wasn't it. But I did a lot of bad things to a lot of people over there, and alcohol just saved my sanity. You see, that's all. Alcohol just saved my sanity. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, what I found out is I can't change any of those things I did. I can't undo them. What you guys told me is all I've got is right now, and if I can put enough nows together, I'm going to have it tonight. That's all. That's all I get out of this deal is tonight. I can't put enough nows together to go back and change the things I did 30 years ago. What I can do today is try not to treat people the way I used to treat them. Try not to react to things the way I used to react to them. Try not to put my perception of what I think I should do into the equation. What I need to do is work this program in all my affairs. And that's what you guys taught me, is all I got is right now. And I don't close the door on my past over there. I need to look back and see what I used to be like. I need to see where alcohol can take me again if I ever pick that drink up again. And I don't want to ever go back to that person. But I did those bad things, and in 1968, during a siege at Quezon, I got blown up, I got wounded. I come back to the States, I got out of the hospital, I went home, and while we were over there, my wife had a son born to us, and I want to get out in those bars and drink, and she wants me to stay home and be a husband and a father. And that new baby's crying, and my daughter wants my attention, and she's growing up, and the wife wants me home, and I got to get out in the bars and talk about the war. Because that's what macho guys do, they can't drop that crap, they got to talk about it forever, for Christ's sakes. And I got to get out there with them so I can be macho. And we're having a cuss fight, and I finally told my wife to shut up. And she didn't. And she kept talking, and I said, shut up or I'll kill you. And she didn't believe me. And I walked in that closet in that bedroom, and I got a gun out, and I walked back in that kitchen, and I said, if you don't shut up, I'll shoot you. And that woman did not shut up. Now, I don't know what kind of drunk you was, but when I told somebody to do something when I was drinking, they better do it. Because I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do. That's what macho guys do, you see. And so I didn't believe in God when I got here, and you guys told me that when you heard this, that there's always been a God in my life, that He didn't walk away from me. My actions, the way I treated people and the way I talked, I turned and walked away from my higher power. He's always been there. And you told me there was a higher power in that house that day, and I didn't believe you. And when I look back now, I said, I know there was. And it was good to know that, because you see, my daughter's pulling on my pants telling me don't shoot her mommy, and a lot of cuss fighting going on, and those kids are crying. I'm trying to get the safety off that gun, and the safety won't come off, and I hit a spring in the back, a button, and it was at the base of the receiver, and a spring come out, and when I pushed that spring back in, it was a firing pin, and there was a round in the chamber, and that gun went off. And that bullet went through my hand, and it went down between my legs where my daughter was standing. And the bullet didn't hit her. And I'm a blessed man for that. I could have accidentally killed my daughter that day. And I'm glad that that didn't happen. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to make amends to her. And I got to treat her like a young lady. And I got to watch her grow up. And she's an attorney in Indiana for a medical corporation. And she invited me to her graduation from law school. And I had nothing to do with that. You see, she did that in spite of her father. She did that in spite of how I treated her as a kid. She did that on her own because she has a God in her life. And she knows how to act like a mature adult, and I don't. And then she had a son 3 years ago, and she named that little boy after me. You see, that wouldn't happen had there not been Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And that I had the opportunity to make amends to her and make a living amends on a daily basis to that young lady. And she's proud of her dad today, and I get to see her, and we talk every weekend, and it's great to have that. And it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't planned on that. You know, shortly after that, I shot myself in the hand, for Christ's sakes, and then she divorced me over it. I mean, you know, I shot myself. She split, she took the kids, and when she took the kids, I drank over that. You see, that? How could she do that to me? I'm a victim again, see? And I went on the drill field, I was a drill instructor down in San Diego, and I abused the recruits and I stole from them. And I'm not proud of that. I needed that money to drink on, and I thought the way I treated those recruits, that's what macho guys do. That was my concept of being a tough guy, and I'm not proud of those actions either, and today I just try not to treat people that way. But after 2.5 years on the drill field, I got suicidal, and I had a keen alcoholic thought. So I volunteered and went back to Vietnam. So guys do. And I was an infantry platoon sergeant this time in 1970 and 71, and all I did is repeat the actions from the first time, and I did a lot of bad things to a lot of people over there. And I got wounded again, and I come back to the States, and the Marine Corps wanted me to come back after lunch, and I couldn't do that. I had to drink. I had to drink to keep those demons away. I had to drink to keep my sanity. I had to drink to keep from remembering all the crap I did over there, those people that weren't involved. And I couldn't come back after lunch. So after 11 years in the Marine Corps active duty, I got out of the Marine Corps. I got an honorable discharge. I got out of the Marine Corps, and I did what macho guys were doing. I put on a gun and a badge, and I became a police officer. Freeze! I love saying that. Newcomers just almost have a stroke. But it does. It helps the sponsor because the newcomer immediately starts doing an inventory. If they got a driver's license, is it current? Do they have car insurance? Do I have any warrants out? You know, it helps the newcomer. And if you can't pick on newcomers, who can you pick on? I mean, stay sober and just pick on them. That's great. You'll have your batch coming in if you stay sober. But I took this attitude on the street with me, and I took alcoholism. I'm afraid of the dark, and I can't tell my partner in the police car I'm afraid of the alleys, and I'm afraid of the dark because now there's demons down there. And if I describe these demons to him, he'll think I'm crazy. So before I go to work, I have a couple of shots. You see, it takes the demons away and the fear. But something else happens now. When you scare me on the street now, I get violent. And I was a violent police officer, and I abused a lot of people in the city I worked in, and I'm not proud of that. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous today, I get to go to the institutions out there in California, Wayside and Chino, and once in a while up to Tehachapi and these places, and I get to speak to the inmates up there, and I make my amends to them. And I get to tell them what kind of person I was when I was a police officer, and I'm not proud. And what I do today is, I try not to treat people the way I used to treat them. And I know you can't tell that I'm still intense and stuff, but I make a lot of amends to a lot of people. I really don't like how people act outside meetings. But I got the 10th step, and I get to make amends, but I make amends to those guys in there, and I tell them about that. And then, you know, I got married again, and then we had a daughter, and then my wife got pregnant. But, you know, I don't feel like a man, and so I still got to validate myself, and so I start to have an affair with my partner. My partner was a female. I just doesn't. You don't think I know where I'm at here in the Midwest? It's just principles before personality. I don't care what your preference is. It really doesn't make me any difference, but it's women for me. So I started to have an affair with my partner, and she found out I got my wife pregnant, and she shot me, for Christ's sake. That ain't funny. Oh, laugh it up. If I was going to be around this weekend, you'd have to make amends to me. She shot me in the head, for Christ's sakes. And I thought, rather than get gunned down in the police car, I'll resign. And so I did. And I got a real estate license. And if you're sitting there tonight thinking that money will fix it, that if you had a lot of money, you'd be okay. If you had a big car, you'd be okay. I bought a brand new Cadillac. I paid cash for it. I bought my wife one. We bought a house on a quarter acre. We put a swimming pool in. I put a 3-hole putting green in the backyard. My kids wore designer clothes. I wore custom-made suits. I wore gold chains and medallions and rings, and I had a Mr. T starter kit before he was ever on television. And I got to tell you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, money and things and stuff don't fix the insanity. It doesn't fix the abuse that, if you're an alcoholic of my type, that you're heaping on your family. It doesn't change the desperation and the fear and the anxiety and the no self-worth and the hate and the rage and the anger. And to be a responsible human being, money doesn't allow you to do those things. You see, because I wasn't paying the bills, and I was drinking it up, and I was still fighting, and I was still unfaithful, and I was still doing all of those things. And at the age of 36, I looked around, and all my life what I wanted to do is be like my dad. He was a good man, he was a decent man, and he set such a great example for me and my brothers, and that's what I wanted to be like. And if you'd have come up and told me that alcohol took me down the wrong path, I could have given you reasons why that wasn't true. Vietnam, and when I was a cop, and how my wife acts, and my kids, they don't treat me right, and I need a bigger house and a bigger car, and I need more money. I need me. I am the mighty I am. But at the age of 36, I looked around and everything I'd worked all my life to get was gone. The house on the quarter acre, the cars, the jewelry, the clothes, the wife, the kids, and everything I owned was in a cardboard box in the back seat of a stolen car. And that's a hell of a note for a former police officer. And I ended up on the street. I ended up very sick. I was passing a lot of blood when I went to the bathroom. A woman I had worked real estate with found me on the street one day, and she took me to a doctor. The doctor gave me a physical, and when he got the results back, he called me in his office, and I sent in his office. He said, "Mr. Jones," he said, "I got to tell you," he says, "you're an alcoholic." He says, "you're dying." And what I felt when that man told me that is relief. He told me I had a hole in my throat. I was hemorrhaging internally from vomiting all the time. I had cirrhosis of the liver. All the crap that goes along if you abuse yourself and live and treat yourself the way I was treating myself, this is what happens to you if you're an alcoholic of my type. And what he told me was, if you don't stop drinking immediately, you're going to die before summer. And when he told me that, I felt a relief. I stood up, I shook his hand, I left his office, and I went straight to a liquor store. I bought me a fifth of 10-Eye whiskey and a case of beer. And I drank as hard and as fast as I could for as long as I could. And I don't know what happened, but my parents found out I was dying on the streets, and they had me committed. I couldn't believe they did that to me. I thought I was their favorite son. I hadn't talked to them in 4 years. And they had me committed, and I was strapped down in a hospital in Indiana. And they called my wife in California and says, "We think you better come back to Indiana. We think your husband's going to die from DTs. He's addicted to alcohol the way a heroin addict is to heroin." And you know what my wife told the doctor? And I'd been married almost 10 years. She said, "Well, let that son of a bitch die." I couldn't believe she said that. I had gave her about 10 good years. I mean, I have been abused most of my life. I am the adult child. I am the husband of an abuser. That's all there is to it. But I tricked her. I didn't die. This committee is not doing this with smoke and mirrors. And her and I have been married 28 years. And that's not because I'm a good husband, because I'm not. And I'm not a good father, and I'm not a good man, and I don't want you to think that. You hear a lot of old-timers get to podiums in Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you how wonderful they are, and that they never make mistakes, and they never do anything wrong, and they're beautiful, and they're walking with God, and they got a wonderful life, and everybody loves them, and it's just wonderful. And if you're new, I got to tell you, it's okay to be a human being, because I'm not a good husband, father, or man today. I know this. I am a good AA member. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in this big book. I believe in sponsorship. I believe in a home group and going to meetings and taking the program outside of the meetings and working it out there to the best of your ability. And I never say no to an AA request, and I do everything in my power to keep my commitments. And so I know I'm a good AA member. I also know this. I am a better husband and father and man today than I was 18 years ago. And hopefully tomorrow I'll be a little bit better than I was today. Because you see, my sponsor says it's progress, not perfection. And I have to believe that. I make a lot of mistakes in sobriety. I do a lot of things in sobriety I probably shouldn't do. And I can do those as long as I'm willing to pick that tab up. I am a human being. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change that. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me the way to live out in that world so I don't have to drink and most of the time not act and treat people the way I used to act and treat them. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. Alcoholics Anonymous has restored my faith by watching you in a higher power that I call God. It has allowed me the ability to treat people a little better than I think they should be treated. And it's allowed me to treat my family the way I want them to treat me most of the time. So that's what AA's done. And I'm just not a good man. But what happened is that I didn't die. And they unstrapped me from this bed they had me strapped down in. And they cleared up my physical ailments. And then they made me go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't want to go because I'm not an alcoholic. It's the only disease in the world that's killing you. And your head says it's always something else. And they made me go to the meetings, and I walked into a meeting in Maywood, Indiana, and in that meeting was a bunch of losers just like you. And I hated you as soon as I walked in. Because, you see, I looked at you, and it was just like tonight. You're all clean, wearing clean clothes, and your hair scrubbed, and you're shaking hands, and you're talking, and kissing, and hugging, and shit. And I hated that. Because I ain't done that in a long time, and I knew that that wasn't going to be able to happen to me. And you ain't been where I had been, and I could tell by looking at you, you look too good. You didn't end up on the streets. You didn't do the things in Vietnam I did. You didn't do to the people on the streets that I did when I was a cop. You didn't abuse two wives and four kids. I could tell by looking at you, because you wouldn't be as happy as you were now if you had. And what you told me to do was, "Frank, why don't you shut up, get your coffee, and sit down." Now that made me angry. And I wanted to rip your face off. You didn't know who the hell I was. And you said, "We don't care who you was. You're an alcoholic. Shut up and sit down." and listen. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If you want to take a drink of alcohol, come to an AA meeting. Go to AA. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I heard that over and over and over, and I hated it. And then you stood up and you wanted to hold hands. And I don't want to hold hands with nobody. Maybe some blonde, some redhead, some. I am the mighty I am. I'm a newcomer. I got a lot to offer. I was living in doorways with my stuff in a bag. I know you want me. Shut up and say the Lord's Prayer. And I'd come back to the meeting the next day and I'd look around at you and I'd think, I'm better than you people. You ain't made the money I made when I was out there. You didn't have the house, the cars, the jewelry, the clothes, the chicks, the diamond rings, the gold chains. You ain't as cool as me. And you said, yeah, Frank, but you ain't got it now. Get your coffee, shut up, and sit down. And go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And that's what I heard you tell me over and over again. And I got to tell you that if you are an alcoholic of my type, and I don't know what kind of alcoholics you are here. Some of you I do. But most of you, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you are. Maybe you can go to one meeting a week. Maybe you can just show up at a meeting and take your birthday cake. Maybe you don't need a sponsor and a higher power and have to follow what the group does. You don't need commitments at the meetings. Maybe you don't need that. But if you're an alcoholic of my type, what happened to me might happen to you if you don't plug into this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't get a sponsor and get commitments and put AA first in your life, before your wife, before your kids, before your job, before your career, because if you don't put AA first, you ain't going to have them anyway if you're like me. And I got to tell you what happened to me. I walked out of that hospital and I stood out in the sun in Indiana and I started crying. And all the things I'd done all my life, you see, I'm sober, came down and started sitting on my chest and I couldn't breathe. I knew I was having a heart attack and I felt like I was being choked out by Vietnam and the wife and the kids and the abuse and the lying and the cheating and the stealing and the ego and the crap. And I didn't want to take a drink of alcohol. I wanted to commit suicide. Where do you go when you quit drinking and you want to take your own life? You see, you didn't tell me that in the meetings, or at least I didn't hear that. Where do you go when you want to take your own life because life is closing in on you? You see no way out of the darkness. You see no way out of the debt that you created, the hate and discontent in your home with your family, with your mom and your dad, and your brothers and sisters and wife and kids. You have no route to go. Where do you go when you want to take your own life? You didn't tell me about that. And what happened to me might happen to you if you don't get involved in this deal, you see. I didn't go to meetings. I haven't had a desire to take a drink in over 18 years. I have had a desire to commit suicide. And I have had a desire to commit homicide. If I'm feeling okay about me that day, I'll take your life. I don't care. And I came back to California. I found my wife and kids in Oregon. We moved into a vacant garage in Newhall, California, in the middle of a vacant field. We slept on the floor. We ate out of a styrofoam chest. We put water on our cereal, and I didn't go to AA meetings. And without AA meetings, at 6 months, without a drink, I hadn't had a drink in 6 months, and I had not been to any AA meetings. I'm driving on the freeway in California in a stolen car in the fast lane, and I honk at this guy, and I tell him to get out of the way, and he don't get out of the way. Now, maybe here in St. Louis, when you ain't going to meetings, and you don't have a sponsor or fellowship or a higher power, maybe you just pull around him and wave, and you're cool. The old show me state. I'm cool. Well, I ain't like that. I rear-ended him. And then when he started to go off the freeway, I chased him. And when he stopped, I stopped, and I had a 45. And when I got out of my car, I walked up to his car, I put the gun in the window, and I said, if you ever drive that slow again, I'll kill you. I didn't want a bourbon and water. I wanted to take that man's life. Where do you go when you feel like that? Where do you go when you're so desperate and full of rage and so crazy and full of hate? Where do you go when you want to take another person's life? I don't want to drink. So I can't come to AA, that's what I heard. And in 10 months, I ain't had a drink in 10 months. And I haven't been to any meetings. And I don't have a sponsor. And I haven't worked the steps. And I don't even know what the big book is. And I'm in Alpha Beta. It's a grocery store out there in California. And I'm buying me Pepsi and cigarettes. You don't think I'm going to buy my kids milk for their cereal, do you? I'm a taker. I've been a taker all my life. I didn't know until I got here that you have to give in order to get something back. I didn't know that takers were losers. And I'm getting mine, baby, and to hell with that wife and those kids. And I'm standing in line with a Pepsi and some cigarettes, and it says 10 items or less, cash only. And my head kicks in. I got the committee back. I'm 10 months sober. And my head said, count that lady's items. She's got 13 items in a 10-item line. Now, what do you think about that when you're in a hurry? When you've got something important going on in your life, what do you do with 13 items in a 10-item line? Maybe here in Missouri you let the little woman go on through the line. Well, my head kicked in again, and I said, you better look at her items. She's got 12 eggs in a carton. Is that 12 items, or is that just eggs? Think about that. There's 2 half gallons of milk. Is that 2 more items, or is that just milk? If she's got 4 apples in that little bag, is that just apples, or is that 4 more items? By the time I got through looking at her stuff, she had about 60. And that's a felony in California. And I'm standing there full of rage and anger, and I'm ready to flip out. And she broke her checkbook out. And I said, you can't write no check in here, lady. That sign says cash. You can't write a check. And she said, I'll be through in a minute, sonny. I said, I ain't never been no damn sonny, lady. And I said, I ain't sonny this minute. And I said, you can't write a check in. And when I get angry, I got to. And I took eggs and milk. I threw it all over the grocery store. I didn't want a pina colada. I wanted to rip her blue wig off. I hated that old woman. That's how I get when I don't go to meetings and I don't stay plugged into AA. That's how I get when I don't have a sponsor and a group of guys that I can rely on in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I get when I run my own life. I'm 13 months without a drink and no AA, and a guy walks in a real estate office and I'm in there and he says, Frank, how you doing? And that's a personal question. Why is this guy trying to pry into my private life? I said, I'll tell you how the hell I'm doing, pal, but I don't want anybody to know. And I grabbed him by the throat. I jerked him on the desk. I started choking him, saying, how in the hell do you think I feel? I didn't want a Bud Light. I wanted to rip his throat out. I had a nervous breakdown. I just couldn't handle life too well at that point in time. Now, I'm fine now. I'm even. And I got to tell you how God works in my life when I don't believe in God. There was an active member of my home group in that office that day, and he'd never been in there before, and he came in and laid a card down, and he pried my fingers off this guy's throat, and he said, I know what's wrong with you, but he said, I can't help you. You need to call this guy. And they took me back to the garage, and they sat with me for about 9 or 10 days. I have no recollection of those days whatsoever. And I just cried. And then on the 9th or 10th day, they took me down to this man's office, and I sat in his office, and I cried. And what that man told me that day has saved my life and sanity up to and including tonight. Because this is what he told me. He said, Frank, he says, you haven't had a drink of alcohol in over 13 months. He said, right this minute, he said, drinking isn't your problem. He said, what you've got right now is a living problem. And he says you need to find the living answer to your living problem. And he says you'll find it in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said there's a group of people that attend those meetings and they've already walked down that path before you got there. All you have to do is get in behind them and do the things they're doing. He said it's an action program. You just got to do the things they're doing. And I'd never heard that before. He told me to come into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit in the front row, and he told me to listen. He told me to keep my mouth shut and listen. He told me to have respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he said there's a group of people in those meetings that are playing you bet your life. And he says you have to have respect and you have to shut up at the meetings. And you can't disrupt it by running around and trying to be cute and be seen. You got to have respect for the people that's sitting next to you. You got to be attentive whether you're listening or not. He told me to get the big book and he told me to start reading it. He told me to get commitments at those meetings. And he told me a commitment means you're a part of the meeting. It means you show up every night at that meeting unless there's a death in the family and it's yours. And I understand that kind of talk. And he told me to shake hands with people. He said, get your sick mind off your sick self. He says, the more you're doing for others, the less you can think about yourself. He told me to get a higher power, and I said, I don't believe in God. He said, whoever puts the moon out at night and takes it down in the morning, pray to them. I can understand that kind of logic. And I got to tell you what happened is I came into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't leap in here and glad hand everybody and hug everybody and turn into a wonderful human being. I sat in the back, for Christ's sakes, and judged you. And I didn't get involved. I didn't get a commitment. And I wondered why the guys that I came in with were starting to laugh and smile, have some kind of light in their eyes, and I wasn't getting it. I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, I don't feel like I'm a part of it. He said, that's because you're not. He said, they're not going to come to you. You need to go to them. And so from then on, what I did is jumped into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started shaking hands. And I started talking to people, and I got commitments, and I was on cleanup the first 5 years I was sober after every damn meeting. And I went to 7 meetings a week for 3 years. And what I found out is the time I had is the same time everybody else had on cleanup. And what I got to do is I got to talk to those guys. And I got to find out that they were like me and I was like them. I wasn't different. And that the solutions for them will work for me. They're suiting up and showing up and taking AA seriously. And having a lot of fun here and making it number one in your life. And I didn't know that. And then I watched you with your kids and your wives and stuff. And I didn't know how to treat kids and wives when I got here. You guys told me, go home and tell your wife and kids you love them. And I said, I don't love them. I don't even know who the hell they are. I said, if I go home and tell them that, I'm going to be lying to them. And you said, well, hell, you've lied to them for 10 years. Go lie to them some more. And so I went home and told my wife and kids I loved them, and I didn't love them. But I told them that because you told me to do it, and I wanted the pain to stop. I wanted the head to shut down. And so I did it. And day after day and week after week, I went home and did that, and I didn't mean it. And one day after a couple of months, I went home and told my wife and kids I loved them, and something funny happened. I loved them. They had changed. I don't even know what meetings they were going to. They had become different. And what I learned out of that little scenario right there is what I learned is it doesn't matter whether I want to do it or not. I just got to go do it. It doesn't matter if I'm ready to do it, if I think I should do it. It just means that I need to take the action and I need to just leave the results. And whatever the results are, I need to accept them. You people taught me that. You've taught me how to be a father. I don't know how to be a father. I had these girls growing up. For Christ's sakes, are they something? I mean, if you got daughters, get ready. Because when you walk in their room, they're not sleeping on their bed. They got their pillows and their blankets and shit on the floor. And they got rollers and curlers and their drawers open and bras and panties and posters. And it used to make me crazy. And I went to my sponsor and I said, my daughter's rooms make me crazy. It looks like someone threw a grenade in there. And he said, whose room is it? And I said, it's theirs. He said, well, then if you don't like what you see, shut the door. It's not your room. It's their room. I didn't know that. I thought I had to control and manage everything. I don't have to control and manage anything. You see, they've got a God in their life, whether they're in AA or not. And it's their God. It ain't mine. And they don't have me bossing them around. And as a result of being able to step back and let my daughters make mistakes and let my daughters grow up, and just mind my own business, and every time they walk by, reach out and touch them or hug them. As a result of that, I told you about my oldest daughter. My middle daughter is going for a master's degree, and she teaches third grade. And she loves her dad, and they call me when I was up there in Canada, and I'm going back tomorrow, but they call their dad, and they love me. And my youngest daughter is 21, and she's a junior in college, and she's going to be a veterinarian because she wants to help sick animals. I don't give a shit about sick animals. But I would have their hides tacked up on the wall. But I have learned that they need to be what they want to be, not what I want them to be. And they don't drink and they don't smoke. They are still afraid to bring their boyfriends around. I was talking to John and Kimberly about it. They're neither one married or even close to it. But they're my little girls. And they love their dad, and I got to also tell you that when you get sober, and I know I got to sit down, but I've come a long way, for Christ's sakes. So just sit there and relax a minute. But I got to tell you that when you get sober, you think everything's going to be wonderful, and all those things sound good, that I have a relationship with my daughters. I have a son. My son has spent 12 out of the last 15 years in state prison. He's a violent, angry alcoholic. I don't know where he got it from, but he is. And what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is he has a God in his life the same as I do. And he'll get to AA in his God's time, not my God's time. And that I just need to love him because he's my son. And I don't need to be proud of him. I just need to love him unconditionally. And you have taught me that, and I do. And since I've been in Canada on this thing I'm doing, I have found out that he's been out of prison 6 months, but he just got arrested for heroin use and fraud and forgery. He's a four-time loser, and there's no parole. He's a parole violator. And he's probably going to go back to prison 25 to life in California. And I need to accept that because that's the decision he's made because he's 31 years old. It has nothing to do with me, whether I'm a good dad or a bad dad. What it has to do with is the decision that he makes as my son. Does it break my heart? Yep. Can I do anything about it? Nope. What I can do is love him unconditionally because he's my son. And I need to accept that. And what I'm telling you is in sobriety, bad things happen. You have good and bad in life, and what you need to do is you need to accept both. Because they happen to everybody, not just us. It's not a personal thing where God picks on us and we can never find a parking spot and the IRS finds us and we're unemployed. I spent 30 months unemployed in 1995 and a couple of years after that, and we lost everything in sobriety. And you know, a drink wouldn't have changed it or undone it. What I did is kick my meetings up to 7 a week. I go to 5 anyway. But I kicked it back up to 7 a week and talked to more newcomers and got more involved in AA. And what it did is it just kept me on the path I was on and allowed me to go home and still treat my wife and kids good. And me and my wife have just had the worst 4 years of our marriage, and there's hope for the newcomer. And I don't know what will happen out of this, but what I do is I don't look for any reason or excuse to leave, and I suit up and show up at home, and I treat her the way I want to be treated, and I don't raise my voice. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that. And I got to tell you that my father died when I was 10 years sober, and I loved my dad, and he was a good man and a good example, and I just went home and supported my mother because she was married to him for 50 years, and you taught me that. Quit thinking about yourself, support your mother, and I had to learn that. And I also found out when I was in Canada that my mom has cancer, and she's not going to live out this year. A drink ain't going to change that. You know, she's lived her life. I love my mom, and I'm going to get to go see her as soon as we get through filming up there. And I talked to the doctor, and she's staying with my daughter and her husband. And, you know, that's all I can do. I can't change what I'm doing. I have to stay plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to try to stay current. I have to stay with you people because you give me your strength. You give me hope when I watch you because we all have the same problems. We all have the same solutions, and so I need to stay with you because this is an action program and the solutions are here. I can't deal in the problem. So what I'm telling you is life goes on and life is good. The last thing I'll tell you is I got back in the Marine Corps in 1986. I was sober 5 years. I went in reserve. Since then, as of March 31st of this year, I have 23 years and I retired. And I get a retirement and a pension and everything when I turn 60, and had I not been sober, that wouldn't have happened. I spent a year gone on Desert Storm, and I come back and I did AA everywhere I went. I am grateful for the life I have today, because the life I have today is far different from the life I used to have. I have a good life today. When I lay down and go to sleep, I go right to sleep. I don't lay there and think and mull crap over in my mind and scheme and try to find an easier, softer way, because if Clancy ain't found it, there ain't one. So why in the hell should I waste my time looking? And if Johnny Harris ain't found one, why should I look? So I just do what's in front of me. I do Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability. I am a human being. I know that AA works because I'm standing here sober tonight. And I'm going to tell you this, and I'm going to sit down. If the only thing I got out of Alcoholics Anonymous is what I got today, I'm overpaid. You see, when I woke up in that hotel up in Canada this morning, the bed that I was sleeping in was dry, and it had clean sheets on it. And when I got here, I wasn't sleeping on clean, dry sheets. And before I came here to you folks today, I took a shower, I shaved, I put on clean clothes, and when I got to AA, I wasn't wearing clean clothes. That's another payoff. I haven't eaten yet today, but when I sit down and eat tonight, when I get through eating, I'm going to hold it down. I'm not going to puke it up with a lot of stomach bile behind it. And I'm going to remember what I had for dinner. And you know what? It's going to taste good. Whatever it is. See, I'm a lucky man today. I got my daughters in my life. I got a chance to make everything go good. I got a job that I never dreamed of being able to do or ever even wanting to do. And it's getting us caught back up on the bills and stuff. And you know, life is good today. In the overall scheme of things going on in this world, you know what? The people in this room got a pretty good deal going here. And I'm grateful to be here. And if you're new or used tonight, you don't need to remember anything that I've said to you. You need to remember what was read to you out of chapter 5, because that's the most important thing I think you'll hear this weekend. And if you follow the advice, you can't go wrong, because it's that very first line of chapter 5. And that says it all. And if you're new, remember that first line of chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I appreciate you having me. Thank you.